This is Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today for the first time is Tara Weber. When I first learned of a significant part of Tara's history, of her, you know, her life, her coming to be where she's at today and this path she's on, when I first learned that she was a First Nation adoptee, I thought, yes, I want to do an interview with Tara. She's climbed many social mountains. She is a person that has a lot to share. People need to climb social mountains in order to be able to follow this path that I'm on and that she's on. The name of this program is Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. We will only have an environmental revolution if we have environmental revolutionaries and other revolutionaries, leaders to follow. And the way you become a leader is Valley Forges, and that was along George Washington's path, and I'm sure he was not the leader that he was until he'd been through Valley Forge. Good morning, Tara.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. This is exciting.
Yes.
So you are from Standing Rock in North Dakota, and that's where your life began. Can you tell us all about that?
Well, actually, I was born off of a relocation program where my biological mom went to Cleveland, Ohio. So
okay.
I was actually born out in Cleveland and was adopted out as a newborn. And so one of the things that I think is really important for people to know, Native and non-Native, is that there is an outrageous number of Native American adoptees, almost, I would say, epidemic level. So that's one of the reasons why I'd like to share my story about the situation that has happened, another situation that has happened to our people.
Yeah, so tell me about the relocation program.
Well, I don't know the details of it, but the relocation program was the program that the United States federal government offered to Native Americans, partly to encourage them to get off the reservation and say we would have educational programs, you know, promising a future for them to go to the major cities within the U.S. L.A. was a big one. Denver was a big one. Minneapolis, Minnesota. But scattered throughout, you know, a lot of us ended up overseas even, you know. So
wow.
It just was one of the things where that's what happened. And so my mom was out on one of those programs, and that's how she ended up there. And she was an activist for our people as a very young woman as well.
Yeah, it just sounds like, to me, it just sounds like another huge dumb thing the federal government did, and worse than dumb, maybe devious and deliberate and horrible. This thing of taking First Nation people that always had that, you know, you think of them as being connected to the land and that being a really major part of their survival, their way, their path, and then to put them in the middle of a huge, horrible American city to start getting used to being away from that other stuff. That seems like more like a smash the person and, you know, ruin the person program than a relocation program.
Yeah, I really think so. I think that a lot of people did staying in the city and had the same type of problems adjusting, but oftentimes, you know, some of them would go back to the reservation.
I think that was very wise. That's what I'd have done.
Yeah. But it leaves, you know, left families in difficult situations because their knowledge to survive and know the system in this huge city really kind of was, like you said, you know, a setup to where, you know, it really wasn't going to work. It was extended genocide, you know, structured to do exactly what they wanted to do is continue to break our people away from, you know, the big extended families of a reservation and then
exactly.
You know, moving us to where they wanted us to go. So it was a big, caused a lot of traumatic decisions to be made for people who couldn't necessarily be able to raise their children at that time in their life.
Yeah, just think that those evil, powerful people sitting up there somewhere would just figure out, okay, here's another way that we can destroy the First Nations of this America. We'll take them one by one and place them in huge American cities where they have nothing but us, and then we'll just play with them. I was thinking of that right when I said it about George Washington, when I also have heard that George Washington did some awful things to First Nation people, so I probably shouldn't even mention his name, you know, but It was inadvertent. I do have a little bit of respect for him when you think of him as being this revolutionary that started it all, you know. And I can't help it. I love all revolutionaries, so I even have a little bit of maybe love for him. And I see, I don't know a whole lot about what he did to the First Nations, but I just kind of have, I think I've heard some, and certainly some about some generals that were in New York State and that did some horrible things to the Onondaga people. And well, maybe it wasn't the Onondaga, it was the Haudenosaunee, you know, the Iroquois people. They burned some villages and destroyed some, you know, the food in the wintertime, and just did all kind of, I think, smallpox blankets and all kind of horrible stuff that was done by the leaders of this, you know, this empire here that we call America back in those days and times. So maybe I shouldn't have said anything at all about George Washington, but you can understand that he's just, you know, this thing of Valley Forge, it just seems like a powerful thing. You know, what a name, Valley Forge, like forging revolutionaries. And I just can't stay away from it, so I may have made a little bit of a mistake there. Anyways, going on, tell us more about what it was like for you and being, you know, like, so your mother was being smashed by these horrible, you know, powerful people that run the show here in America. And you didn't even know that because you were, like, then separated from her and you were off on your own path. And you know, it must have felt pretty much like you were being smashed. Just tell us about it.
Well, my life, I had a great life. I was raised by a non-native family in the suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. And I had a lot of opportunities. I never went without basic needs. And I got a good education and a lot of post-education opportunities is traveling. And so I thought I had a really good life, but I don't think it was until maybe my early 20s where I started to realize the impact of on my spirit, which I probably didn't identify as my spirit at the time in my whole life, about being the only brown person in a predominantly Caucasian culture for my whole entire life.
Yep.
And I think it takes years to undo the layers because what you don't even realize. I mean, how do I realize if there's no one there to help me realize, of who
exactly.
I am? You know, so that was, I think, you know, it's an identification crisis, you know, and you think you know who you are, of course, when you're in your 20s. You know, you own the world, but I would say I had a general feeling of being lost probably my whole entire life. And it was interesting because I feel like I have a very outspoken, outgoing personality. And I talked to a childhood friend of mine that I recently reconnected with after many years. And she said to me that, you know, as a child, she saw me to be kind of shy and quiet. And I think I was withdrawn because I just kind of felt like I didn't fit in. And
yep.
I felt like that a lot through college.
Yep.
I went to college in the Midwest. There was probably less than 5% minority on that campus. So I guess just as the situations compounded, and then I started to look back at who I was and why I wasn't feeling particularly right, maybe depressed even.
Yep.
And then looking at it for what was, you know, what it was really worth. And I think people that knew me, they didn't see it that way. Well, you'll have people saying, you know, oh, I never saw the color of your skin. But I want you to see the color of my skin.
Yeah.
I wanted you to see the color of my skin and identify that, you know, I'm a Native American. And the fact that you only know one or have ever met just one tells you a story, too. You know, if you're in the United States and you're in the Midwest and you've only met one Native American person, it shows you what has happened to our people.
Yeah, to think about what it used to be, there was just such a, you know, I do not know what the, say, like the total population numbers were, but to think that, you know, whatever they were, that they were the dominant society of that, you know, they say the Great Plains and all that amazing, mm-hmm. the whole country. But to think, like you say, here we are in the Midwest, the place where, you know, the dominant culture, as it was everywhere, but still, something about the Great Plains, I just feel like that is so awesome and just so high-powered. To think that the people that were the dominant culture there would come to be, you see one of them, you know, in this, these, you know, your life path, you know, these other people. Wow, what a, you know, a loss and what a change for the worse. And just, there have been so many atrocities, so many, you know, like, gone down the wrong paths by so many people, so many bad results, and just, I guess it is that you just want to, like, somehow roll over top of that and just keep building into something that will improve on things. You know, and I'm, you know, 56, and I just keep feeling like, well, where is it? You know, when is the improving on things going to get ahead of the destroying things? And, you know, when is the balance going to be that the good improvements are more than the bad, you know, damages, and that we start getting higher in the human existence, you know, and building into a higher place than going into a lower place? And truly, I have to say that, you know, if I was just going to say, and I'm going to say, that it is going down. The human condition is, seems to be going down to me. And I don't want it like that. I'm trying so hard to get it going the other way. So it was something inside you, that you just kind of gradually became aware of, you know, was like telling you that you needed to do something about something inside you. And then you just kind of like, what were the first, you know, what was like one of the earlier things that you did to kind of start following that thread and, you know, be, was it just thinking about it? You know, say you just started thinking a lot and you just thought, okay, it is this thing of being a First Nation person. That's what I want to kind of address and like get into. Was it like, you know, sitting around alone just thinking a lot about, you know, these feelings and these kind of like these senses, like the sense of loneliness and that kind of stuff that you were saying about?
Yeah, I think absolutely the loneliness, the unknown. I felt this huge drive inside of me, you know, and that compelled me to do something. So I for my 30th birthday, I said, that's it. And I was working in the state capital of Ohio for the government, ironically. And I said, you know, for my 30th birthday, I'm moving out there. And I moved out to California and started to go to powwows and got my first job with the Native American organization. And then slowly found my way to South Dakota. And I always knew that my biological family was from, you know, South Dakota and Standing Rock. So I didn't have that unknown to try and figure out. Because what's important for people to realize that a lot of adoptees don't have their proper records, or on their birth certificate, it doesn't say, you know, it might even say that they're Caucasian or Hispanic rather than Indian. So they have a whole nother, you know, set of problems to deal with. So I didn't have that. But initially, I think I kind of paced myself. I just wanted to experience the culture. So while I did my research, and I probably thought finding her was going to take longer than it did, but I enrolled in the local college in Rapid City, South Dakota, the Oglala Lakota College, and I started working with the kids in the Indian education program in the school and doing a lot of the social work, because I've been a social worker for 10 years up until that point, and working with families and kids, and it had a whole new spin on it when I saw the struggles that the kids had, but at the same time, I was a part of learning about the culture and attending the powwows and ceremonies and just being around people really that look like me for the first time in my life.
Yep.
That was really, all of those things were very emotional. I think it takes a while to process it. And I kind of jumped in a lot, you know, with not knowing. I just threw my heart into it. This is what I wanted to do. And it's very overwhelming, but it was something that I don't regret. I'm so glad I did it for myself. And it was something that I could only do for myself that no one, you know, would be able to give me.
That is so awesome. That is so awesome. I wonder how many other people have, you know, actually did it. You just felt like you did it in such a, you know, a well-ordered kind of like you must have this great ability to deal with your emotions, and you're just kind of like your, you know, your path. You just, like with me, I have to say that it, I don't think, you know, and it was, it's totally different, you know, everybody's totally different, but I don't, you know, just kind of comparing myself to you, I just kind of feel like, wow, she, you know, just kind of like sensed something that she wanted to deal with, and she just smoothly just kind of like got into figuring that out, and it was such a cool idea to go to, you know, this place where there are more, you know, First Nation people around, and just, you just kind of grasped it so capably, and then just did it. I would go do things and quit them, and just, it was much more. I don't know. Maybe you just tell this much. I have to say, it's very impressive. Can you just tell us some about what it was like at the powwows? What it was, just give us an early experience, of you, like, so you thought about doing that, and you just, that's, you're so lucky, in some ways those powwows are so cool, and the, spirituality is a part of it. Tell us about getting into the powwows and then getting into the Native spirituality.
Well, I think one thing that was kind of an interesting time frame for me, when my friends started getting married and having children, this was my baby and my marriage, was to go do this for me during that time frame. And it was very difficult. I appreciate you saying that it sounded like a smooth plan. But, the emotional journey, just, it was exhausting. You never know what's going to be behind this next door. It's a big risk because it's the unknown. But there's such a draw. My first time out to Indian country was for an actual consulting job in Arizona on the reservation. And when I drove myself down there to the res that day, and I saw the land, and I just felt like I connected. I got emotional, and I knew that I wanted to come back and at least, feel like a part of it. And then when I got down to the police station where I was doing the training, and I saw all these brown people come in, I just felt like, I kept getting these reassuring situations that I was doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And then I went to this one woman's weekend, and that's when I went to the first powwow, and it was a small powwow, and people were aware of my circumstances, and they were very supportive and very hopeful and helpful. And one of the dancers, said, "Your people's powwow is coming up in 2 months out in South Dakota. You need to go. You need to go." So it was something like that. I don't know that I would have ever necessarily done that, but once that idea was put in my head, I knew that it was something that I wanted to go do, and I did. I traveled out there by myself, made my way, and when I went to that first powwow that was in the Black Hills, I knew that people from my tribe were there. I didn't know who anybody was, but there was thousands of us, and so I just took that all in, and I just couldn't believe it when I finally heard the language spoken for the first time. I was 30 years old when I finally heard my own language spoken. And to me, that was just what I found later figured out from the elders and people that, taught me and supported me was, that was, I came home, and I learned that we all come home. It's in our spirit to come home. And that was one of the emotional days that I knew that I had done the right thing for myself. But at the same time, it makes you feel even more lost because you see all these kids dancing in their regalia, and you didn't have any of that. You didn't have, the kids feeling comfortable around the drum and dancing, and that, it was a social environment. Everybody knew each other.
Yep.
And again, you kind of feel, you're left out in this community, and that's how you feel. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's really happening. It's how you feel on the inside.
I said, I know exactly what you mean.
Lost and lonely.
Yep, mm-hmm. I felt that way a lot myself. And it's like that when I see something that is this good thing that other people have and do and stuff, then I just kind of feel like, geez, I didn't have that. It is difficult. It is like, you need to see these things to get into them, and yet there's that thing there that you just, it really does. You just kind of feel like some pain there, that you just missed that, this lost thing, it's in there. It's in there very much.
It's excruciating. It's excruciating. Now that I can look back and see, I guess you don't realize the pain as much. And with my situation, because I've met a lot of people who've had the same experiences I have in terms of being adopted out, my family was supportive of my journey. My family, supported me in special ways too, So there are other people that don't have that, where there's a conflict. And so that's also a difficult thing. And even when you do have the support, it's still an adventure.
I think what it is, I think it kind of like what it is that a person can only tolerate so much change, you know, like coming at them in an instant, you know, like say like a person can only handle so much, you know, like changing their mind about something and kind of like having the feeling of say like loss or like the feeling of like anger or the feeling of like, you know, just a negative like thing, you know, say like with your encountering this stuff and with me encountering the things I've encountered. You can't change real fast because you just can't handle it happening. You know, like, say if you all of a sudden had to, like, boom, deal with all the loss, you know, of not having had all that in, like, say, half an hour, you know, it'll be just impossible for the human being to deal with that. And so it does have to be spread out and just slowly, you know, just gotten into. And I know exactly what you're talking about just from my own personal experience.
You're right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, that lost Indian kid in you wants all the answers. Now that you got it in your grasp, you know, your answers, and you think that this might, you know, resolve some of these feelings, which it did for me, luckily, just wanted to happen. You've been waiting all your life for this to happen, but then it is absolutely overload. You don't know what to do. And again, I had support, you know, and I went into ceremony, healing ceremony. I had mentors. And I had a good situation, and it's still quite devastating. It really is. It's hard to explain it, and it is. It's a broken spirit, you know. And unfortunately, only you can mend your broken spirit and make that choice if you wanna, you know. Because to mend your broken spirit, you still got to go through a lot of painful doors,
yep.
A lot of unknown doors, but
yep.
and really be willing to take that risk. And just. You know, and our people, Lakota people, are known for being strong, headstrong, and I think a lot of my genetic factors played into, you know, I was determined to get my answers and find out what I wanted to find out and feel a sense of where I came from.
Tell me this, has there been a, like, this thing inside you that you were following that is about connecting with that particular land, you know, that environment out there in South Dakota?
Absolutely. I think one of the things for me is I just would always love to drive out there, and it had a real meaning to me. I know specifically once I found my birth mom and saw all the wonderful work that she had done as far as advocating for water rights, And we're talking on an international level, not just, you know, for her local community, as well as saving the Black Hills and how it belonged to, you know, our people and how it couldn't be bought and that we would never buy that. And for me to have that connection that my biological mother felt so strong about that, that made me so proud, not just of her, but where I came from and what our people stand for. And how they are showing the world right now about, you know, coming back 7 generations later and being the ones to restore the land and the language. And all my biological family members are a part of doing that. So it just, when you hear about the different types of things like you and I have talked about before, you know, the land being poisoned and being misused or being cut through to build, you know, things to make money and use up natural resources, it just is really devastating, you know. And like you said, there's so much work to undo that, but can we catch up to what's been undone?
Have you found any, you know, are you aware of, say, I know there's this plan to build the Keystone XL pipeline, and would that be coming down across the Dakotas?
Yes. That's the plan, but of course, and even some of the people down on Pine Ridge have already tried to stop trucks from cutting through there and addressing that. I don't know a lot of the details about it, but I know from what I have learned that that's not something that our people support, having come through the land.
I can imagine.
And it's just something that I think that, you know, everyone is trying to make positive changes out there, and that's only going to bring more problems. I do know one of the things that I noticed when I went down there was a lot of talk about the uranium being in the water. And so I often wonder, you know, if that contributes, based on my own situations and research and being involved in certain things, if that contributes to the high rate of diabetes. You know?
Well, tell me, is uranium mined in the Dakotas?
You know what? I don't know exactly how it got there.
Well, I see. So maybe it didn't come from, like, say, mining activity. It might have actually been, like, say, dumped there or something.
I think the latter, but I could be wrong. So I don't want to be don't
sure,
quote
sure.
me. No,
yeah, there's just
but,
an endless amount of mystery in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, and it just, you know, I don't know. And you know, based on the situation, you and I have a mutual friend who lives in Mohawk country, and there was toxic waste dumped there, and just how it goes completely ignored, you know, until people, you know, get sick and dying. And even when that happens, you know, what's the accountability for that?
Right now, the accountability is you and me, you know, and Larry Thompson and Dan Lee Thompson and Nettie and Thompson and, you know, all of us that have that. You know, I love that song when it says, "When you feel so powerless, say what you want." You know, it's just so awesome that it's out there. People are saying things that need to be said and
mm-hmm.
just kind of like joining together and building larger in their saying these things that need to be said. And accountability is such a necessary word. I do a bunch of writing. See, I'm a Green Party leader, and in running for Congress, I've been doing a huge amount of writing of these media advisories, these news releases, these, you know, these papers, all these various things that writing, and I've gotten so into just trying to make it powerful, and the words of some of these songs that we have, and then just a few words of what to do, you know, to bring changes and to
mm-hmm.
just get a better world than what we have right now. I've really gotten into that, and I just love it the way it feels like it's coming together. It feels like that there are. It was so cool when I met you. You know, I got to know Larry. It was so Larry dug in to the hazardous waste, the toxic mound, they call it, there at the former General Motors. They call it was GM Powertrain Massena. You know, up on the St. Lawrence River, huge amount of electrical power, supposed to be the people's electric power. From this, I think it was called the Moses Power Dam, and then they end up calling it the FDR Power Project for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This president, they had this idea of public power, but then it's not public power, because what it ends up being, it's GM's power, and Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, they have a bunch of the power there now, and they got that power, public power, then they used PCBs, and they poisoned the people. And
mm-hmm.
Akwesasne, this Mohawk Reserve, downstream and downwind from these industrial situations, these huge factories where the PCBs were used. Well, now there are, not just now, before now, quite a while before now, but well established and clearly documented now and a while before now too, you know, this is really going on a long time. Alcoa, this Aluminum Company of America, actually built its factory up on the St. Lawrence River back in the 1800s. And I'm sure they started using PCBs probably quite early in the game. And Monsanto invented PCBs in the 1930s and started distributing them. So here we go. During the course of the 1900s, the Alcoa and the Reynolds, which was another big aluminum company there, that is now owned by Alcoa. There's Alcoa 1 and Alcoa 2 now. And also the General Motors, they all were three, these huge factories, using PCBs during that whole 100 years, and Akwesasne downwind from it, so the PCBs are evaporating into the air from where they were dumped and where they were spilled and where they, you know, were in the world. People of Akwesasne breathing PCBs for many, many years, and downstream from it, so their drinking water is taken out of the St. Lawrence River, and these PCBs are in the St. Lawrence River, so they're drinking PCBs. And there's the wildlife, horrible stories of the most contaminated duck ever, you know, captured and destroyed and tested, the most more PCBs in a duck at Akwesasne than any place else on Earth. These baby turtles, you know, before they were even babies, these unborn turtles tested for PCBs found to be so heavily contaminated they had to be disposed of as hazardous waste. This is an outrage, and yet where's the accountability? I have contacted the government about this, you know, the federal government, the state government, the county government here in St. Lawrence County, trying to get them to just do something to educate the people on the whole story of their exposures. And no, it hasn't happened yet. And they don't even talk about it to any significant extent. You know, they might, you know, say maybe do a meeting once a year or some ridiculous little token thing. It's not happening. There's zero accountability. Zero. And if you can help me figure out how to establish accountability, I certainly would honor you for the rest. You know, just yeah, it will be. That is such an important word, and it's so much where the people that are concerned and want to bring good change. I think that's where we need to go first. You know, I really believe that the truth coming out about the bad government is the way to get a good government. It makes sense. You know, good governance has got to include accountability. You know, it's like a family. If there's no accountability for, like, what dad and mom do, well, then it wasn't a good family. And if there's no accountability for, you know, like doing your job, then you didn't do a good job. This is very basic stuff, you know. And the government deliberately holds off accountability.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, we've diverged a little bit. So let's just get right back on this thing of discovering our roots and building our life in that discovery. So you run a company called Eagle Creek Entertainment. How did that come out of your experience as a First Nation adoptee?
Oh, let's see. I think my love of music and my love to work with my people and work with people. Being a social worker, I like to work with people and give back, trying to help people that are in the music industry, that are Native American, and try and bring our music to maybe a different place, different places than it already has been, or bring it back, and just try and develop, you know, a good business. As I co-own it with another Native American woman, Daris Reno, and she's Cherokee. And so what's interesting is that I thought the name is to honor our families and our ancestors before us. So the eagle comes from my biological grandmother's name, Pretend Eagle, and then Creek comes from her Cherokee name, Running Creek. So we put the two together.
That's cool.
Eagle Creek, yeah.
You're so lucky. You're so lucky to have, like, those threads to draw upon in, like, just creating your life tapestry. You know, the names of my relatives, they don't have, like, you know, like, Garbisi is my mother's maiden name, and my father called himself, I stumble right there, you know, he said Hessig, I say Hessig, so, you know, see what I mean? You know, they're not words that we know the meaning of, and maybe there isn't even any meaning to them, there must be. But even that, not quite even that simple, is that I don't even like the way Dad pronounced it. You know, it's quite different, to say the least.
It is. It's a beautiful culture. We come from beautiful, beautiful culture.
Yeah, I love it. I first got into, say, the music and the dancing. Like, it wasn't powwows that I first encountered with the First Nation people. It was the social dances. I love dancing. It is kind of cool the way the dancing has always been there with me. I noticed in high school that I liked, you know, rock and roll, and I liked, you know, I only went to a few dances, but I certainly did like them when I went. And I was always socialized. I guess I should just say that, you know, that's kind of like how I'm, you know, interested in kind of like saying in this interview that I know about some of the things you're talking about. I was asocialized in high school because of being, you know, just moving around a lot and just not fitting in and being very different than the other people that happened to be in that place, and, you know, not difference in skin color and difference in, say, like, as much of like a cultural thing, but it was in this personal way of being, you know, that I was like just so into mindfulness and just doing the right thing and thinking a lot and all this kind of stuff. And the other people that I was immersed in were not that way in the least. And so it was like this culture shock of a different kind. And it was a socialization that I encountered. And it was, you know, my brother actually read a book about it. He told me about it, and that's the word for it. And it was very painful, and it took forever to, like, get through it. And then I just kind of continue to just kind of get through it and become free. It's this thing of feeling free. And so the dancing, I've always thought of as setting me free, and I certainly felt the freedom of the dancing that was going on there at Akwesasne with these social dances. It was so wonderful to go to these buildings, these beautiful log buildings that were the longhouses there. There were two there. There are two there on Akwesasne. And to come into there, and there's just all these people in there that you can feel the love between them and, like, the good vibe and just the excitement and just all these good things that I did not encounter in ever. No one encounters with that in, you know, the white society that I was part of. And I just felt like, this is, you know, I feel so good. I just wish I could be a part of this so much. And, you know, the problem is, you know, even though that felt so good and that was coming along, I wasn't part of it. And there was, you know, there always is, there's other stuff going on. And so it turned out that, like, you know, the people that I happened to be trying to be a part of that with, they didn't really feel that comfortable with it, and I was coming too often, and then they didn't want me coming so often, and it just, you know, it's not a smooth path, you know? So, So tell us more, your love of music. Let's talk about love of music. This is, we could talk about this all week.
Music saved me. That's what I say. I grew up in Cleveland, and they had rock and roll shows coming in there, you know, and I was very blessed. I got to go to a lot of concerts and do a lot of good things with, you know, with music and being involved as a teenager, and it always kept me going, you know.
And then
when a little less than 10 years ago, I was sick, and I was a single mother, and I wasn't going to be able to work full time outside of the house anymore. So I thought, what could I do that would make myself, you know, have a career, but be able to accommodate the fact that I'm sick, you know? And so one of the things that I did was remember that, well, a professor told me I was a good writer. I heard that again when I went out to South Dakota, that I was a good writer. And so I put my love for writing and music together. And so what I started to do was become a journalist for Native American Entertainment. But it was difficult, like anything, you know, in that industry to get your foot in the door. And I happened to be at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland and saw that Robbie Robertson was coming, you know, and he's Mohawk. And I was able to get an interview with him. And ever since I interviewed him, I was able to sell my articles afterwards. He really helped me get my foot in the door. And he's been very supportive of things that I have done since I met him. So it was a really positive thing. And I loved it. I got to go to shows and write about things that I would have been there anyways. So
yeah, don't you love it?
It was a fun time. Yes, I love it.
Just following your heart, you know. You feel this great love for music, so just follow it. You know, just do it.
Yep, and it worked out great. It's, you know, and that kind of is how it got, you know, the business developed and, you know, making contacts and meeting new people and in the business. And one thing that I have seen that never gets old is the incredible amount of generosity that Natives have, and the amount and the as much as the big part of their spirit and their heart they're willing to give back to support their own people, especially the youth or the elders, or something's happened in the community. And it can even mean sometimes maybe someone going without to give to somebody. Hmm. And that's something we do not see like that in mainstream America for just, you know, or someone's been, has gone through something like a suicide within their own family, and to be able to try and turn around and give back to keep that from happening. And the generosity is just amazing to me. So that's something that I don't think people realize unless they get to know someone that's Native, or, you know, like you, see the beautiful things of the culture, you know, that you got.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, because at the social dances, they would always be having these, you know, like they just say, we have a blanket, and let's we're raffling that to make some money for somebody who's having a difficult time right now. There was always something like that going on, you know. They were just, that was part, a major, you know, it was right there always in the social dance. And it was just, it all felt good. It felt like a good group of people doing something good, That I love that music. That they had this, like, I think it was a drum that was a had was like the shell of a turtle with some, you know, skin over that, and they just this tapping, this gentle tapping really on this drum, and it was such a beautiful sound that it was like this very much like a heartbeat kind of sound, you know, being, you know, on that small drum, like just gently tapping it like that. It was so cool, you know. And this guy, I think his name was, I never even really knew his name, but the name that I associated with him, and maybe I'm even wrong, but it doesn't matter. I always thought his name was Mike Laughing, you know, and it probably was. And I thought he was just so cool, you know, being there, leading those people and just going around that room, that beautiful room. And, you know, it was a lot of people in there, maybe like, you know, over 100 people, you know. It was just so cool. And I'll never forget this guy coming out of the, coming out of the social dance. I guess we would just go outside and hang out for a little while, maybe when there was a break, or maybe at the end of it, I don't remember. It's quite a while ago now, way back in the, I'd say the late 80s, maybe the early 90s, a long time ago. But I remember Mike saying to me, the guy I thought was Mike, he said, "You are like a monkey." And I thought that was so cool, you know, because I love the idea of being full of lively energy and just, you know, just, I certainly do dance like a monkey in some ways. I'm really big on hands. I don't have a tail, but I'm big on my hands moving around. And I really, you know, and I don't know if he meant it as a compliment or whatever, but it felt good, you know. Just have another human being just tell you, like, you know, just say something about your dancing, and just, it was really cool, you know. I'll never forget that, I'm sure. I'll just always remember having a person, you know, just come over and just say, you know, just something real. I love the real. Just being real is just so cool, you know, and so much what it's all about, that I'll always remember that as a cool dance experience, you know, that I had. And dancing has just been, it's me. I was doing a campaign event at my alma mater. I went to college at SUNY, you know, State University of New York, Potsdam College in the St. Lawrence County here. It was about 25 miles from home. I drove back and forth. And I was doing a campaign event there this Friday. And I have a campaign website. And so I get a comment on my blog, on my campaign website. And this student, he's saying, "You should stop doing the dancing. You should only do that when there's DJs or live music." And see, I'm thinking right away, this is the conventional. This is the conventional speaking to me. So I emailed him back, and in a nice way, I said to him, "You should learn to embrace the exceptional." And, you know, my heart is about loving dancing. And I can't give, I just can't give people what I get to give them without doing the dancing. So, like, it's got to be that way, you know. You know, he told me that I need to cut my beard and wear a tie and a suit. And it was just like, you know, the conventional is so entrenched. He was saying that people were laughing at me. See, it was really cool. It was actually this really unusual venue, because what I did was I got the opportunity to, they have free speech policies on the State University of New York campuses, a lot of them. And so at my alma mater, I was doing a free speech event, and I selected a place that was other than the designated venue. There's this thing called the designated venue where you're supposed to do your free speech, and that doesn't really feel all that free, so I'm glad that I didn't do it there. I didn't want to do it in the designated venue because that was right near a highway, well, a road, where there's a lot of stop and go, stop and go, stop and go, because they have signs, stop signs there. And so you're breathing all these exhausts of starting the car, you know, I mean, not starting, but just starting up and taking off. And, you know, I'm big on not breathing exhaust. So I'm thinking about this, and I selected, you know, I actually had to go all the way through the president. The president of the college had to say I could do my free speech other than in the designated venue. Well, I got to do it behind a union where there's no cars, you know. So I'm out there, and ended up being so cool because I'm worried about my audience, and there it was. There's all these huge glass windows that I'd totally forgotten about on the back side of the union. It was the perfect time of day. It was like 4:30 to 5:30. No, I mean 3:30 to 4:30. All these students are done classes. They're sitting in there. I had this huge audience, and I couldn't really see them. You know, they're in there, so it was good that I couldn't see them and finding out what some of them were doing. This guy that emailed me, and, you know, I mean, put this post on my blog, he said that there were people laughing at me. And I thought, well, that's cool. They don't get it. And I said to him, they need to think of, is there laughter to harm the other person, or is there laughter, a pleasant, positive laughter, you know, laughing along with the other person in joy of, you know, good things coming down, you know. And so I think it was a great opportunity to just kind of, like, you know, just encounter in a strong, good way, you know, something that needs encountered there on that campus, you know. It sure is cool. It's amazing how dancing will bring out, you know, because it is. It's just being free. It's being free. It's giving people as much as you can give them. I'm sure the dancers of old and of now and forever are always going to be people that just want to give. It just feels like that. I just feel like I'm giving them myself, you know. It feels so good, you know.
good for you. Good.
Yep.
I heard you were a dancer, Donald.
Yeah, it feels so good, you know. I just you say about loving music, and I just, it is this thing, like I'll just hear a song and I just feel like that song. When I dance to that song, I just feel so alive, you know. Lady Gaga, Born This Way, Tom Petty, I Won't Back Down, you know, U2, In the Name of Love, Nickelback, many Nickelback songs. Nickelback, If Everyone Cared, Tragically Hip, New Orleans Is Sinking. Those songs, I just feel so alive when Kryptonite by Three Doors Down. I just feel so alive when those songs are there in my presence and I'm able to get into them and just be me in those songs. You know, man, it feels good.
I agree. I love it.
There's no more to me. You are not, you know, being fully alive is being in music, you know. And all the people come to me. Last night I was dancing in this discotheque in the town of village of Potsdam. These two guys come to me. You know, they're tall and well dressed, and you know, they consider themselves to be very dominant. But, you know, they said to me, "Can you provide me some drugs?" I looked at them, and I pointed up
what?
The disco lights. They see, I have long hair and I have a beard, and I guess somehow that causes people to think that I'm a drug dealer or a druggie or whatever, you know. They just said to me, right in the middle of the dance floor. They just catch me in the middle of the dance floor. It was dark in there, and there weren't any police around. They just said, "Can you provide us some drugs?" And I looked at them, and I said, you know, I've heard this before plenty of times, so I'm into it, and I'm able to deal with it. I just looked at them, and I pointed the lights, and I said, "That's what's where the excitement is." And then I, you know, I just kind of drifted my hand up in the air, and I said, "It's the dancing and the music. You know, I've never done a drug in my whole life." And he said, "Well, that's..." He said something about, he looked at me in this kind of like mean way, actually, you know. He was like displeased that I wasn't going to give him what he wanted. And so this, you know, this American brat, you know, he looks at me as if like, I could like almost like harm you for not giving me what I want. And he said, "That's not good." In this kind of like really like disapproving, nasty way almost. And I looked at him right back at him and I said, "Yeah, not good for you." Because you're not going to get what you want, but I've got what I want and I'm trying to share something beautiful with you. It was totally awesome, you know. It just felt so good to just say what I want to say to him and just deal with it right there in the moment. It's so clean. It's awesome.
Good.
Yeah, I'm not about drugs at all. I believe that drugs are a horrible... There must be something missing in people to feel like they need the drug, because I never felt like I needed it. There was always the music and the dancing and the forest, and, you know, I guess I love the path in the forest, you know, just as much as the path on the dance floor. And I did truly start my dancing in the forest. I was out in the farm. On our farm, we had a big farm in the St. Lawrence River Valley. You know, not a farm that you make money from, but a farm that was like a farm should be, where we just had a few cattle and raised our own vegetables and fruit, and you know, a beautiful farm in the St. Lawrence River Valley. My dad was a veterinarian, and so we didn't, you know, have to make money off it, and you know, that was the key, I guess. So we just did some farming, but just the farming we wanted to do. And you know, we did kind of make the mistake of doing too much of the kind of like raising Holstein replacement heifers and this kind of stuff, which wasn't beautiful and it was ugly. And we figured it out. We just gradually figured out that the cows were supposed to be pets, and you know, it was beautiful. And we were lucky. I was very lucky, like you, in having parents that were very supportive and would just kind of nurture and just kind of let you have the opportunity to follow your path. You know, my dad, he was critical. He did say some stuff that, you know, was painful, and that, you know, he would just kind of, you know, say that he really felt we were screwing up and not being veterinarians and not, you know, getting a good job going and not having, you know, the money to, you know, have a home of our own and, you know, spend our time working rather than walking in the woods and, you know, raising the garden stuff. And he was critical to the extent it was, you know, he wasn't, I don't think he was quite as nice as your father. He was actually mean about it to some degree. So, you know, everybody's got their issues. But still, he did give me that opportunity, like you're talking about, to follow the path without, you know, I didn't have to go off, you know, to like New York City to find myself. I could find myself in the cedar forest of the St. Lawrence River Valley, you know, on our farm, and just be content and happy there for a while as I figured out, you know, who I was and what I was really about, you know, and I had to do it, and I'm glad I did it. I started dancing out in the woods one day. I was back there and just thinking a lot, and I just felt like nature wants me to dance here. I just started dancing there, and I felt so excited about it. And for days and days afterward, I would find all these beautiful places that I knew about and go there and dance, you know, because that was what I wanted to do, you know. Wrote this poetry about it, just really flourished in it, and I never looked back, you know. I just grew and grew and grew in it ever since, you know.
Good. Everyone needs that. Hopefully, well, everyone needs that opportunity to do that. Hopefully,
that's right.
They just,
you know what there truly should be? Truly, the government should just look at the situation there is right now and say, the government should say, the best thing that could happen is if everybody took a vacation. Everybody could have time to figure out where their path really is, and just, you know, basically, you know, how can we make it so that everybody could follow their heart for at least, you know, it took me a long time. Probably some of us need to follow our heart for years and years and years, but we at least get to do it for, like, say, a year. I wish there was some way that everybody could have the opportunity to follow their heart for a year, you know. I bet we'd have a whole new world just like that.
You're
so
right.
Cool. And yet how does the person that's doing two jobs to take care of their kids down in New York City or something, how do they follow their heart, you know? It just seems like it's so hard.
It's too crowded. Everyone
yep.
lives on top of each other. That's not normal.
But how could they get out of there? How could a person that had, say, several kids and that was, like, just struggling to have a roof over their heads, you know? I guess they could. They could just say, we're leaving. We're just going to go and see what happens, you know? You know, people are amazing. They probably could do it, you know, if they just set their heart to it, you know? I don't know. You did it. You impressed me again when you said that thing about figuring out how to have the making a living, you know, and be, you know, more free, you know, to deal with, like, your sickness and your single parent situation and all this stuff. That's very impressive. I've been trying to figure out how to actually make a living from what I do, and I still haven't figured it out, but, you know, I don't care. I just keep figuring it out. I keep trying to figure it out, but you impressed me again there. You
Thank
said,
you.
I thought about it, and then you did it, and you obviously did it, you know, so it's pretty cool, you know.
Sometimes it happens when you're a parent. You have no choice. Boom, you got to get to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. You. I can tell from the tone of your voice and just your attitude, you project this thing of like a, you know, this kind of like, I want to get the right word for it, this captain of your destiny. You know, you are a captain of your own destiny. You're very much a captain of your destiny. It's really cool, you know. It's a really cool way of being. I wish I could be more a captain of my destiny, you know.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I never thought about it like that.
Well, yes, your tone of voice and the way you describe your experience of life, it's just there that you looked at it, you figured it out to a degree, and then you just did it. You just jumped into it and did it in a very, you know, it sounds very capable to me, and I'm sure it was very capable, you know, to have accomplished it in as rapidly as you've accomplished it. You were 30 when you started really getting into figuring this stuff out, and here you are, you know, I bet you're not like any more than like, say, late 40s, if that, you know, probably not, probably like mid-40s, maybe even late 30s, I don't know. And
no,
here you are.
I'm early 40s, Donald.
Okay, so there you go. In barely 10 years, you've got it going, you know, major. I'm 56, almost 57. I'm way behind you. So I'm certainly less a captain of my destiny than you were a captain of your destiny. And the truth is, you probably had, well, it's hard to say. I'm not going to compare which path was more difficult to follow, you know. You can't do that. It's impossible to do, you know. So, you know, what more? I always ask people, what left do you have that you want to say to me in 5 minutes?
Let's see. Let me think.
There's got to be something that, you know, just you know, let's just stop. We don't have to make any noises. Let's be perfectly silent for a minute here on this radio program. Let's be perfectly silent and just think.
I think for Native adoptees that I hope everyone finds their journey to healing, find who they are, and find the answers to their questions. And for the biological family, which is something that is not always, you know, addressed, that how difficult it has been on them to grow up without a sibling and to hear as they're growing up the sadness, you know, and the mother thinking about the child that she gave up, and that there's struggles on both sides, and there's pain on both sides, and there's healing that needs to happen. And I got good advice one time, you know, that blending families is not always easy. And so it's not always the way you want it to be, but if you can, you know, do what you set out to do, you can't control everything, even though you're the captain of your destiny. you know, there's some things that are gonna, you're going to come across that are painful or not work out the way that you want them to. But, you know, I just never use the word never in terms of, you know, everything can heal possibly. Everything has the opportunity to move forward. So that's what I hope for the families of adoptees and you know, the adopted families. You know, there's always issues with that too. So it's a complex issue, but I think healing can happen. And one of the things I wanted to mention was a powwow that is for Native adoptees. And more information at wearecominghome.com. It's on November 1st, and it's at the Minnesota American Indian Center. And that'll be something that will be very special. Unfortunately, I cannot go, but it's something that I would like to be involved in the future.
We Are Coming Home.
Yes.
Yeah, that's powerful. Wearecominghome.com, and it's a powwow of and for Native American adoptees. You know, I'll bet there's a lot of healing that comes out of that. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, this thing of healing, I'll say it, boy, your heart feels different as it heals. And anybody out there that their heart doesn't feel, just somehow they just know. They know it is not a heart that is fully healed and it needs healing. You know, you can feel it. You can feel that need of healing. Isn't it cool? I just love it the way there are those things inside us as human beings that lead us and are the guides that we have. You know, I wonder, you know, I don't know whether it's spiritual or biological or a combination of both, but it is real. It is very, very real. And
mm-hmm.
something led you to healing. Something led me to healing. Something's
mm-hmm.
leading other people to healing. And I'm just so glad that we did this program. You know, it just, this is, you know, you saying that there, that your hope is for the healing that you've experienced for these many other people that need that healing. That's beautiful. That's very, you know, just right on, you know, so real
Thanks.
And right on.
I appreciate it. And thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tara. You have given me a wonderful gift here to be able to share with other people. And I'll put it out there on the Internet. It's radioforall.net, and it's going to be a program in the series, Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. And I'm thinking, boy, the people that have their hearts healed in these things, they're going to make fantastic revolutionaries, you know, and bringing
mm-hmm.
the great changes that we need to make for the, you know, for America and for the world in the next, you know, few years.
Yes, we're all warriors, even if we don't feel like it all the time.
Yep, it's in us. It's in our heart.
Yes, definitely.
Well, thanks,
Tara.
I hope you the greatest successes, and I'm sure that we're going to, you know, get more and more connected as we move forward with doing what needs to be done up there at Akwesasne as far as raising awareness on this toxic mound, getting that out of that land of the First Nation people.
Absolutely. That sounds great. I look forward to it.
Yep.
Thanks again.
Yeah, viva the revolution. Have a great day.
You too.
This has been Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. I'm Don Hasig. You were just listening to Tara Weber with Eagle Creek Entertainment. Tara is a First Nation adoptee. I almost said was. She will always be a First Nation adoptee. This is a path, you know, that was her life. She lived it. She has found healing of her heart in connecting with the powwows, with the spirituality, with the land of the First Nations, with the people of the First Nations. It's out there. It's all there. Healing of the heart is always right through these doors that she spoke of and that I know of and that we can walk through together. Viva the revolution. Good day.